Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host tonight, Red Beckman and Dr. Kate. And I've got a little echo going on here in my ear, so I need to try to get that cut off, which is not uncommon. Try to get in on the chat line so I can watch that during the show, and sometimes the online stream starts playing in my ear. Well, Red, you want to say good evening to our listeners tonight?
Yes, I'm just happy to be here. I'm looking forward to this program. And so I'll be trying to keep my old ears tuned in so that I don't miss a thing. So welcome to the show, everybody. I hope a lot of people out there are listening in tonight. Because it should be a good one.
Could I ask you to do the honors to open our show, please?
I can. Heavenly Father, we come to you recognizing our weaknesses and our inability to remedy the situation that we have in this country, knowing that we have a lot of problems, and we're going to talk about some of that tonight. We have a lot of problems, and the problems are much bigger than we are, and we're going to need your help and your guidance, your wisdom, and help us to be available. If you need someone to speak, hopefully we can be available to where we can speak out as needed. We thank thee now for this privilege. It's a privilege that we recognize as having a great value because of all the people that have access to this program. And we just thank you for that, and we just pray for your guidance and your help that we might say the right things at the right time and have solutions rather than just more problems. So we thank thee now for this opportunity, and we'll give you the praise now for everything in Christ's name. Amen.
Well, amen. I thought we were going to have Larry Cooper from the Evolve Expo on with us here for the first few minutes of the show to give a promo on that. I'll just give everybody a heads up to go to the website, evolveexpo.com. That's going to be a great alternative energy and alternative health conference here at the National Western Stock Exchange in Denver, starting tomorrow evening and running through Sunday. It's going to be some great exhibitors. Natural Grocers is actually sponsoring it. That's Vitamin Cottage here, for those who are not aware, and should be a phenomenal expo. They got like 100 exhibitors and a lot of speakers like Foster Gamble and a bunch of others that will be giving lectures there at the expo. And I think the price of admission is only like $10 for a day or $25 for all 3 days. So it's a great expo that we've got here, and everyone should go and check that out. They're doing like a free energy house set up and the whole nine yards. So should be great. Larry, you have a live mic.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing?
Doing very good. I didn't know whether we were going to get you on here or not, so I went ahead and started
talking
about the expo.
I was I was listening in. You're doing a great job. I don't know that I need to add much. We do have some great speakers, and that admission price of $10 includes all the speakers. We didn't charge extra for individual speakers like we've done in the past. We just wanted everybody to have a great experience and be able to learn as much as they can and experience these great people. We have a couple of speakers that are pretty unique. Dr. J.B. Hill is Napoleon Hill's grandson. If you know Napoleon Hill, he wrote a book called Think and Grow Rich back in the 30s, 1930s that is, and it's still one of the largest selling books in history, still selling off the shelves, and we're very excited to have him come in and talk about vision and all of the things that his grandfather was teaching in the book Think and Grow Rich. And we also have Dr. Joan Borsinko on the program, who's a Colorado author and very much going to teach us about alternative health care and well-being and, you know, just living a lifestyle in Colorado that lends itself to a healthy lifestyle. As you already mentioned, Natural Grocers came in as a sponsor, and one of the things that I asked them to do originally that they are doing is we set up a stage, and they're bringing in celebrity chefs from the city, and they're going to teach us how to cook with grains, especially, you know, all those bins in those great natural food stores. It has all those grains and all those things. I have no idea what to do with, because I grew up during the time when all we did was use packaged food, add water or whatever it is, and we need to get away from cooking with GMOs and all the other chemicals that are in our food. So they're actually going to teach us how to cook for the 3 days that they're there, and it's a great opportunity to experience what they're going to teach us. They also are bringing in 50 different vendors over the 3 days that are all local food vendors, mostly they're their local foods, which are organic as well as non-GMO.
Yeah, I got to call her tonight.
And so you'll get to sample all the foods and then visit the other 70 or 80 vendors that are in the hall also. Everything from wealth building to alternative health care to conscious living, and then other food vendors there also. So kind of a unique show and a great opportunity to take a look at, you know, what's out there and what the other possibilities are.
Well,
oh, yeah,
I'm really excited.
I said Rod Smith is going to be there also, the former Denver Bronco wide receiver. We're really excited. You can't tell by my own energy. We've been working all day setting up, and we're just about ready to go tomorrow. And it opens tomorrow at 4 p.m. and goes till 8, and then it runs all day Saturday and Sunday. So we certainly invite all of your guests to come join us and look forward to seeing you there as well.
Well, I'm excited about it. I'm sure there's going to be some new faces that I'm looking forward to meeting. And, you know, we've done a lot of interviews here in the past with alternative energy people and some alternative health folks. But I'm looking forward to really seeing the exhibit, especially that free energy house that you've got set up. You might want to just mention that before we go.
Well, we decided not to set up the whole house. What we did is we set up two big areas with all kinds of live experiments, and we've been trying really hard to just expose what free energy is, what's available out there, because it is phenomenal what's really available. What we found over the last 2 months is about half of the guys and gals that committed to being in booths and in the house pulled out of the show because they're being threatened, and they're going into hiding. They're scared, and that's terrible to say, but it's reality of what's happening in that whole field. I'm hoping that some of these incredible inventions do come to the market, and a lot of them aren't new. It's the old Tesla technologies that have been around for a very long period of time. But unfortunately, we probably lost half of our exhibitors in free energy. We still have about 14 of them there, but we were hoping to really just max it out and do some really unique things. But I can understand where these people are.
Yes, this is an ongoing problem, and I'm really hoping that folks like Foster Gamble can take action on some of these and present them in a way that will keep them from being so threatened by, you know, from these other oil companies and banksters that have been doing this for a long time. We're so far behind the curve because of the abuse that's been put on these inventors, and this expo is an important thing for that, and I'm truly looking forward to it. Larry, I know you got to run. You got an early night tonight because we got a big day tomorrow starting out, and I'll let you go. But okay. I look forward to visiting with you at the expo.
Thank you very much, and you guys have a great show tonight. Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Bye-bye.
I just want to mention, give a kudos to Crusade Radio, to Jim Cook and Doug Millar, who are simulcasting with us this evening. So welcome to all the listeners for Crusade Radio. And our guest tonight, Robert John, attorney from Alaska. Robert, thank you very much for taking your time, and I understand Maria Rentzel's on with us as well. Robert, would you please start us out, say hello to our listeners, give them a little background on yourself, and maybe talk a little bit about how you got to know Schaefer Cox.
Certainly. Hello, everybody. My name is Robert John. I've been practicing law in Fairbanks, Alaska since 1989. I've handled a lot of appellate work, and I do some criminal defense. That's become a large part of my practice, especially over the last few years. And I originally met Schaefer probably around 2006. I needed some work done up at my property, and I answered an ad in the newspaper, and Schaefer showed up, and he and I hit it off immediately. He talked about philosophy and law and constitutional issues and the like, and over the next 2 years, we'd get together on occasion, sometimes when he'd come up to the property and sometimes outside of that, and he continued to work up at my house, and I'd go over to his house now and then and have dinner with him and his family, and he and I became friends, and then I represented him a little bit in 2010 with some issues related to the state. But then in 2011, these charges were brought against him that started out as state charges, and there were some federal charges filed as well. I represented Schaefer in the state court proceedings for, six, 7 months, maybe 8 months or so. It took and was ultimately successful after several motions in getting one granted that the judge ruled that the evidence that had been gathered against Schaefer, these supposed recordings by the informant, were impermissibly gathered without a warrant. They were illegal. And at that point in time, the state basically threw in the towel and dismissed all the charges, not only against Schaefer, but all his co-defendants. And that pretty much brought an end to the state court proceedings. And at that point, there were federal proceedings against Schaefer as well, and I did a little bit of work in the federal proceedings into, I think it was January of 2012. I wasn't his primary attorney there, but I did file a motion to address some of the improprieties that were done by the government and its informants in holding Schaefer in Fairbanks and other things as well that led to the charges against him, and that was ultimately denied. So I saw Schaefer most recently at the end of December, talked with him for 3 or 4 hours. He's doing remarkably well. He's very cogent. He's believing in this, and the problem right now is he has an attorney who doesn't seem willing to pursue the issues that he believes should be pursued, and I agree with him, issues that need to be pursued. So he is right now trying to get another attorney. He'd like to get me to represent him, and that's one of the things right now we're trying to do is to gather up a fund toward his defense.
Well, that's very important that we get Schaefer released. You know, it's amazing that the state recognized that the evidence that had been brought against him was illegally gathered. Not only that, I mean, we've talked on this show in the past, and we've, you know, I met Schaefer back in 2009, so did Red Beckman, my co-host here, and so did Dr. Kate, our producer here. we all met Schaefer back in 2009 and really enjoyed him. And after reading his own letters and testimony about what went on, it's just amazing to me that a federal judge could even believe for a minute that any of the charges that were brought against him were true. And it's, you know, that's just verified by the fact that the state of Alaska saw fit to throw it all out and release them. And yet the federal prosecutor and judge and infiltrators that were sent in, it's just amazing that they were able to railroad him through the way they did. And we certainly appreciate your willingness to come back into this and to handle this appeal. Robert, if you could talk a little bit about this federal jurisdiction, because it's my understanding that they really did not have jurisdiction at all, and that for them to even bring these charges was wrong because it wasn't up to them. It was really up to the state. Am I wrong in that?
Well, I have not looked personally into jurisdictional issues other than there may have been some jurisdictional issues against some of the weapons charges in the sense there was no interstate commerce involved. The charges that involve a conspiracy against federal officers, which were, I think, completely ludicrous, but they somehow managed to convince a jury about them, there would be federal jurisdiction there if there was, in fact, a conspiracy against to murder federal officials, which there wasn't, but that would be a jurisdictional basis for those charges, though I have not looked into the federal jurisdictional issues that much.
Understood. Let's talk a little bit about the jury. They did not allow this trial to go forward in Fairbanks, correct?
They did not. I think that it would have been much better to have had it up here, and perhaps the government had the option of where to file the case, and I think for their own strategic reasons, they chose to file it in Anchorage because perhaps they would be more likely to get a jury to convict. Up here, I think if this were folks in Fairbanks knew of Schaefer and understood him a little bit better, and I have to qualify this, is I was not there for the trial in Anchorage. I have not read the transcripts. I've talked a little bit with Schaefer and some of the folks involved in the case, and I know what I know from that, but I was not there. But I think if this trial had been held in Fairbanks, and if there is a retrial, I would make every effort, whoever is the attorney, I think, would make every effort to have it held up here. There was an effort made to get the case tried in Fairbanks, and the judge denied that, there was, I think, an option to try and renew that, and I don't know if it ever got renewed or not, but there were some good reasons to have it in Fairbanks in the sense that the events happened here, the witnesses were here. You know, it made more of a hardship on the people and Schaefer's attorney and other folks who had to basically live in Anchorage for 6 weeks, where the U.S. attorneys got to basically walk down the hall every day and go to court. So, you know, I think having this trial in Fairbanks, if there is a retrial, would be something to definitely fight for. And I think a jury of Fairbanksons I'd be surprised if they would convict Schaefer.
Yes, because they have a much better feel for what really went on. Maria, you've got a live mic. I just want you to know that you're free to jump in here, kind of act as a co-host with us. We really appreciated you being on here a few weeks ago and sharing so much about Schaefer's story. Would you like to say hello, and do you have any questions to start this discussion out?
Sure. Hello, everybody. Thanks very much for having us again. I would just like to, I'll go ahead and just mute out and listen, but there were a few things that RJ brought up the other night when we happened to run into him in town, and as I remember those questions, I'll chime in and ask him some of those.
Super. Thank you very much for being here. Tell us a little bit, Rod, about the appeal process. You know, there's a number of different things that go on at this point after a conviction like this, And it seems like there's they're not all just mixed together. Like, for example, I know that a lot of people don't understand the limitations of what you can address in an appeal versus what would happen in a retrial or post-conviction matters. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Basically, in appeal, as a starting point, you're limited to the record that's been developed previously in the trial court, so you can't bring in new evidence. You're not necessarily limited to raising issues that you raised in the trial court, but if you're raising new issues, there's a higher standard for the consideration of issues that were not raised or objected to in the trial court, because it somewhat makes sense that if you want to object to something, it's better to require an objection to be made at that point in time so there's a chance to correct it or avoid the problem. But so in the appeal process, I'd be, there was some issues filed, a number of pretrial motions that were filed by Schaefer and joined in by Schaefer on some of the issues. So, and those issues relate to the inception of the prosecution, and that was one of the issues, some of the matters I dealt with, particularly involving the actions of the informants. To look at some of those, there was the evidence was pretty much that whatever Schaefer was involved in, if anything, on February 19th of 2011, he basically said, in no uncertain terms, "I'm done. I'm leaving here. Goodbye, everybody." And at that point in time, the state's informant, or the government's informant, the principal one, was named Gerald Olson, called J.R. Olson, Schaefer knew him as, probably panicked because he was in a situation where he was facing a number of serious felony charges. He had prior felonies, and what he had done is defrauded many, many people by promising to put in septic tanks or whatever. They paid him a lot of money. He buried cars in the ground. He did other things, and he had taken all their money. Sometimes it was elderly folks, is all the money they had, and he'd seriously damaged lots of people, and he was going to go away for a long time unless he somehow made himself out to be the hero. Well, what happened when Schaefer announced he was going to leave, the first thing J.R. Olson did was take the battery out of Schaefer's car under some guise of doing something, and he then proceeded to come up with a ruse that there was a trucker who was going to come and take Schaefer down to the lower 48, a completely fictitious person. And he basically, at this point in time, Schaefer was pretty exhausted, and he and the government were well aware of that. They kind of kept Schaefer in town till March 10th or 11th, whenever they managed to set up this little plan they had to put some weapons in his hands and arrest him. So there's a lot of issues with that, issues with some of the other things with the other informant, Bill Fulton, and that's issues relating to appealing matters leading up to the prosecution. Then there were some issues raised, and my understanding, relating to the search warrants that were issued for the trailer where they supposedly found some weapons. And then we get to the trial, and there's issues relating to the trial. I wasn't at the trial, but it seems like, just from what I know of it, there may be some issues there, too, where shortly before the trial, it's my understanding the government filed a motion to basically stop the defense from presenting as evidence most of the 100 or so hours of recordings that the government itself had made, and that motion was granted. So, excuse me, I'm getting over a cold, so if I get a little hoarse, I apologize, but... So Schaefer was basically prevented from presenting evidence at trial, a lot of the matters on the recordings, and a lot of the matters on the recordings actually would have corroborated Schaefer's testimony. So that was one of the problems, and there may have been other problems at trial about evidence that shouldn't have come in. Some of it was certainly objected to. There's issues at trial relating to, I did do a little work with Mr. Traverso, his attorney, on proposing some jury instructions. A lot of those jury instructions were not given. So there's issues relating to how the jury was instructed on defenses that Schaefer had and on just generally the standard of proof and certain First Amendment issues that came up in the context of the case, because a lot of this case had to deal with questions of was this all happening as basically free speech by Schaefer, and what the government was in a sense doing was punishing Schaefer for his free speech. And that's kind of the issues that arose, and the way the appellate process works now is there's a transcript. There's about 6 weeks of trial. There's several days of evidentiary hearings. I don't know how long the transcript is, but it's probably somewhere in the vicinity of 5,000 pages. So we have those 5,000 pages. We have the various motions that were filed and the evidence that was presented, and that's going to comprise the record for the appeal, and that's going to be what we're arguing from for the appeal.
I do have a question.
Go right ahead, Maria.
I'm sorry. RJ, there was you brought up kidnapping, and you kind of talked about kidnapping as it related to the person taking the battery. I guess it was J.R.? Is his name J.R. Olson?
Yeah, I think that's what Schaefer knew him as. His name might be Gerald, but he was J.R. Olson to Schaefer and people in the case.
Okay, and he took the battery out and didn't allow Schaefer to leave. And that's one of the kidnapping issues. But the other one, and I don't know if you were involved in the case during this time, but the Alaska Department of Child Services was coming after Schaefer's son.
That was a matter that happened in 2010. And this was one of the things that, you know, Schaefer was concerned that the government was trying to take his child, and they did make an effort to do that, and that was ultimately defeated. But in the process or during this time, Schaefer had gone to the military base here seeking a refuge of sorts, and had spoken with one of the military police there, and this gentleman confirmed this and testified at the trial about it. And I don't know the exact testimony, but basically what happened is after Schaefer had come and left, a bunch of federal agents descended on the military base and seized all the videos and recordings of Schaefer being there. And in the course of this military officer's contact with these agents, they basically told him that they were trying to provoke Schaefer into an act of violence by trying to get his kid, and that would put an end to Schaefer because they would then do away with him. So this was conveyed to him by the person from the military base because he was very concerned what he heard the federal agents say. So Schaefer, and quite legitimately, had a belief whether this was actually going to happen or not, that people were after him and his life was in serious danger.
Right, and I understand. I actually talked to the man because we my husband and I went down and testified on Schaefer's behalf, and I talked to the man that you're speaking of, and he related to us because we weren't able to listen in the courtroom. We were sequestered. Yeah, so we couldn't hear his testimony. But what he related to us after this was over was that he went to his commanding officer to ask if it would be okay if he spoke to Schaefer about what he had heard these federal agents saying, and then he wasn't even comfortable just with the okay of his commanding officer, so he went to the JAG at the base and got a legal opinion before going to Schaefer about it. So he was very cautious, and he did testify on Schaefer's behalf at having heard that. And, you know, for some unknown reason, it didn't apparently convince the jury that he had a good reason to be concerned about the federal government coming after him.
Right. And that might be one of the issues, I think, with the jury instructions, because one of the problems may have been the jury wasn't properly instructed as to how to consider whether Schaefer had a reasonable belief that his life was in danger or not. And so they might have, you know, I don't know why they actually believed he would actually attempt to do anything against to hurt anyone, but if he had a reasonable belief and was acting out of a sense of self-defense, he should have been acquitted, even if they thought he was going to do something. And I think there might have been a failure in the jury instructions in that regard.
And then the other thing that I remembered that I hadn't known before, talking with you the other night, was that the state case was really going to be the big case that you thought you were going to try, and the federal case was really not as big a case.
That is correct. The state charges involved crazy charges that had no basis in reality, but involved threats against judges and attempted murder of judges and other people, district attorneys and whatever. And they were looking at sentences of, like, you know, 20 years or more in that potentially. And the federal charges at the beginning were just a couple simple weapons charges that probably, worst case scenario, Schaefer might have done 3 to 6 years in jail for. And once the state charges were dismissed, the federal government upped the ante once, I think. And since I wasn't really there representing him, I think they upped the ante a second time. And when they upped the ante a second time, that's when they threw in the charges that have resulted in the really long sentence, the conspiracy to murder charge. So, yeah, that's what kind of happened. His federal case transformed from the secondary one of much less concern as far as punishment consequences to growing into the huge travesty that it's become.
And then the weapons charges, apparently at least one of those weapons charges, he had gone to the ATF agent here.
Yes, he did. And my understanding, and this was somewhat very strange, because I had sought to have that charge thrown out in that motion, along with the other bases of my motions, that we argued in January of 2012, and the judge, I think, probably correctly ruled that no, he couldn't throw those charges out. That would be for the jury to do, and he would deal with that with the jury, because what basically, it was something called entrapment by estoppel, where if a federal agent, and certainly an ATF agent, would have the authority to do that, tells you, you talk with them and communicate and say, is this okay? And they say, yes, it is. And you go ahead and do it, they can't then go prosecute you. Well, when it came time to go to the jury, the judge kind of backtracked and refused to instruct the jury on what he had specifically said at the prior hearing the jury needed to be instructed on. So Schaefer was not allowed to assert his defense to that at the trial, or to, he was allowed to put on testimony, but there wasn't a jury instruction that to go with it.
Is the fact that they prevented the defense from having access to certain evidence, is that a part of the appeal process?
To the extent that there were motions raised at the trial on specific evidence, it's part of the appeal right now. To the extent there's other evidence that perhaps should have been revealed that's now becoming clear, that would have to be dealt with perhaps on a remand, but I believe one of the pieces of evidence that was brought up, and I don't know if there were motions filed on it, but the other informant in the case, the one who made a lot of threatening comments toward Schaefer and actually put a knife to a gentleman's throat to try and promote Schaefer to go to violence, Bill Fulton, he had made some recordings of his debriefings by the federal government, you know, and they didn't like those recordings. So what happened is they took those recordings from Mr. Fulton, and when the defense requested those recordings, they gave the recordings back to Fulton, and he supposedly destroyed them, and the government claimed we don't have them anymore. So that might be an issue on the appeal. I don't know to what extent that was fleshed out in the trial court, because, as I said, I haven't read the transcript, but that could be an issue of evidence that was withheld that should have been brought forth.
See, what was the name?
Pardon?
Go right ahead. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
What was your question?
I was wondering about the name of the federal judge.
The federal judge's name was, I believe, Robert J. Bryan, B-R-Y-A-N, if I recall. He was, basically what happened is all the judges in Alaska recused themselves from this case, in part probably because of the involvement as Lonnie Vernon as a co-defendant, because Lonnie Vernon was being accused in a separate case of trying to murder Judge Beislein. And some of that evidence may have come in this case, and that probably didn't help Schaefer. But so Judge Bryan out of Seattle got assigned to the case.
And who actually brought the charges?
The United States Attorney's Office of Alaska. They're primarily based in Anchorage. They have an office here, and they try some cases here, but they filed the case in Anchorage.
The state attorney's office, not the federal prosecutor.
No, the United States. There were two separate cases. There was a state case brought by the district attorney's office in Fairbanks, and that proceeded in the Fairbanks courts in the state of Alaska court system, and that was the charges that I was working on and got thrown out. The federal case was filed in Anchorage and proceeded down there.
So do we have an actual name of the U.S. attorney that brought that?
The U.S. attorney for Alaska, the primary attorney under whose name it was filed, is Karen Leffler. But there was two or three attorneys who were the ones who handled it all the time. The principal attorney's name was Mr. Scrocky. I'm trying to recall his first name right now. But what you need to understand is the U.S. attorneys are all very, very good attorneys. I've dealt with them. They're among the best and the brightest, and they took their top attorneys and threw them at this case and expended probably well over $1 million in resources on this. So they didn't take this lightly, and they threw all their best at it. So it was a battle all the way. And the attorneys representing the various defendants were all very experienced attorneys. So this was you know, a case where it was very difficult. And one of the things that would happen, and you know, the government with all its resources has so much it throws at the case, to what they would do then, for example, right before trial, they hit the defense attorneys with hundreds of pages of discovery and new things to consider, kind of to like, here, this, look at this right now. And it's very distracting to try and prepare for a case when they're constantly bombarding you with new evidence or basically overwhelming you with evidence, and you've got to sort through it all to figure out what, you know, what's relevant and what's not, you know, and you have the resources of private counsel that are retained by individuals with limited amounts of money against the government with all its money. And one of, I think, the you know, difficulties of the case for everyone involved is Schaefer and Coleman Barney, too, were certainly business people who, if they had been allowed to stay out on bail, would have made significant money in the year or so that the case went on, or almost probably a year and a half or so, and been able to help finance their case. But the federal bail system is very difficult, and from the inception, everyone was thrown in jail, and no one was able to get out and do anything towards supporting their own defense.
I did check a couple of those names, U.S. District Court Judge Robert Bryan, and then U.S. Assistant Attorney Stephen Scrocky.
Yes, okay, Stephen, yes.
Mm-hmm, yep. And so now, I don't know if you're ready to move on yet, Terry, but I was really interested in, unless you want to continue to talk about prosecutorial misconduct. It sounds like there's plenty here. This kind of brings us up to date, though, to what's happening with Schaefer's attorney, Suzanne Elliott, speaking about Schaefer's mental, as if he has a mental illness, that he's delusional, that any counsel that Schaefer would get would, he would reject any counsel because no one would buy into Schaefer's delusion. And she went public with that statement, and it came out in the Alaska Papers. And so that kind of brings us to the current time frame. Schaefer he's asked to fire her, and I'm not sure exactly what the terminology is there, but he wants her off the case. And he's also filed a bar complaint. And I looked that up the other day, and I found out that the bar complaint came back to him, and I don't have it in front of me. I'll look for it, but it said that he wasn't, during the appeal, he's not allowed to decide who his attorney or, he doesn't get to pick who the defense attorney will be. Is that? I'll have to look up the wording. But apparently,
yeah, I'm familiar with that. I saw that order. I believe I saw it yesterday, and I did a little looking into the legal issues that were pointed out in there. And this is one of the difficulties that's arisen is that, you know, Schaefer and Ms. Elliott are definitely at loggerheads and see the case differently. And I see it more along Schaefer's lines. And she, has been going to do a brief, and she's a well-known attorney, but she's not prepared to challenge the actions of the government, and she's not prepared to challenge Schaefer's convictions other than the most serious ones. So right now, in the best-case scenario, if she were to handle the appeal, she's not going to throw out the prosecution, she's not going to challenge the convictions of Schaefer for the other charges, and she's not going to throw out any evidence, and basically Schaefer would still stand convicted if she were to prevail on the issues is intending to raise. He still can't stand convicted of the other charge, and is probably looking at 10 or more years in jail as a best-case scenario. And, you know, there may be more issues to raise in relation to the most serious convictions that she's not raising. If I were to represent him, I'd have to go through that transcript. And what the court basically told Schaefer is that you don't get to pick who your attorney is. If you have an appointed attorney, you can make objections, but there's a lot of discretion in your retained counsel. So that makes the thing all the more serious in the sense that really Schaefer's best hope right now is not necessarily to try and get a new retained counsel, because that may be difficult, or he may not get to choose me if he does it. But the objective, I think right now, the better objective would be to raise funds to get private attorney in to represent Schaefer, because that would be the clearest way to get Ms. Elliott off the case, because my understanding would be if a private attorney says, I've been retained, I'm entering the case, you know, then she would have to step aside. But right now, absent her agreeing to do it, and she doesn't seem willing to step aside, it's going to be difficult for Schaefer to get another appointed counsel. And if I were to represent him, I had told him I would agree to do that, but there are difficulties with, one, getting me in there, and two, the whole payment thing. I'd prefer to work, you know, or whoever would be retained to work for a private, on a private basis, so I'm not being paid by the government. And that's kind of
well,
what that's
and frankly, and frankly, I believe that you and other councils that might step in at this point really have no desire to be on the government payroll. This situation, you know, really brings that out. I mean, look at the intimidation that was put on Schaefer. Look at the intimidation that was put on the other attorney that in my mind possibly failed to challenge the actions of the actually refused to challenge the actions of the government. I mean, let's face it. I mean, if I were to go out and start talking to somebody who really had not done their homework, had not done their research, somebody who really had red, white, and blue fever, still had faith in this government, believes what they're told on the mainstream media, on the television, believes what they see coming out of the movie production studios, they would think I was delusional. But the fact of the matter is those people like Schaefer who have really done their homework and have seen the kind of racketeering that's going on and the kind of tyranny that's coming out of this federal government, you know, it's not delusion, it's research. It's actually look at the facts, look at the big picture. Well, you know, maybe she's legitimately saying she thinks he's delusional. I would suggest that she is naive and has her scales over her eyes and is not willing to face the truth about the people that are really behind our government and our federal government particularly. So, I mean, join the club. I mean, there's a lot of us out here that could be perceived as delusional, but simply because we know things that other people are not willing to face. And Schaefer, certainly a very bright young man, and it is just a shame that we don't have him out here working with us to try to overturn the tyranny that's going on. So there's more at stake here than just Schaefer. We need people like him, and they're going to continue to take us down. They're going to continue to take anybody who's willing to speak out against the criminal syndicate that's behind our government. They're going to continue to take us down. So we've got to come together. It's either hang together or hang separately, right?
I agree. And you know, Schaefer's case is one of the most important cases to come along in our lifetime. And, you know, people make donations to various politicians and political things. Well, this is as political as it gets in a way because it's the government coming down on someone. This is nothing new. In the 60s and 70s, they were doing the exact same thing to people on the so-called left. Now, here we are, flash forward 40 years down the road, they're doing it to people on the so-called right. It's the same thing, deja vu, but it's just different people who are getting gored by this. And it's really, you know, you can stand up for this, and this is as important as any political race that one would contribute to. So, you know, winning Schaefer's case, getting Schaefer out so he can do his things, but establishing precedent and holding the government accountable for what's been done in this case is incredibly important.
RJ, we have a caller from Alaska that's got a hand up, would like to ask a question.
Certainly.
Is that okay if we take a call?
Yeah.
Mr. Olson from Alaska, you have a live mic.
Good evening, gentlemen. Yeah, Norm Olson here with the Alaska Citizens Militia and Michigan Militia, and you probably know the history of all that. Ray Southwell and I, very good friends of Schaefer Cox. We've broken bread with him and spent many, many hours speaking with him and talking about the issues. Now, I'd like to ask, Mr. John, do you know what the composition of the jury was during the federal trial against Schaefer Cox?
The composition in what sense, as to where
in,
they were
the,
from or were...
The number of jurors that sat on that jury, and also what kind of a vote was necessary or what kind of a verdict was necessary by a majority? Was it by unanimous opinion, or what? How did that go?
Well, it would have been, I wasn't there, it would have been a 12-person jury requiring a unanimous vote to convict Schaefer. Now, I don't know
where
the jurors were from, if it took place in Anchorage.
Right.
Yeah.
But if it was a unanimous vote to convict or to find Schaefer guilty, then I have a real issue. There was a gentleman on the jury by the name of David Oberg, and he had talked with Ray Southwell on a blog following the proceedings of the trial, and he said this to Ray Southwell: Ray, Ruby Ridge did come into play during the trial after the prosecutor asked a witness how anyone could possibly believe our government agents would fire on a citizen without first identifying himself, a position Cox took on explaining why he felt a security detail for him and his family was necessary. This is what Mr. Oberg said, and he confessed before Ray Southwell as a juror. He said, I was surprised during deliberations to discover that fellow jurors had no idea of what happened at Ruby Ridge, and I had to give a history lesson to them to bring them up to speed. Now, that really annoys me, because when Mr. Oberg gave a history lesson, you see, when jurors get together and they talk about the facts and the evidence of the case, they are not to go into a long soliloquy and a monologue about history and their biases and their insights into the evidence. If they had a question about Ruby Ridge, they should have sent a note to the judge saying, we'd like to have a history lesson of what took place at Ruby Ridge. But this Mr. Oberg went ahead and he briefed them on the events at Ruby Ridge. Now, whether he was for Schaefer or against Schaefer, he invoked and provoked a bias opinion among those jurors. And if that's the case, and if they were not objective in looking at the evidence, and it was biased by Mr. Oberg, then that constitutes jury tampering. That somebody had put more information out on the table than the evidence, which should have been, it should speak for itself. The jurors are not permitted to go ahead and comment beyond the evidence and go ahead and talk about their own philosophies and their own biases and such as that. Do you have any comment to that, or would that be part of the substantiating evidence that there needs to be a retrial, because other factors, not only this, but other factors also point toward a tainted trial, and now with this, Mr. Oberg's confession, a tainted jury?
That issue would probably need to be explored in a separate proceeding or a motion. It wouldn't be something to bring up on appeal, because the jurors' comments and any affidavit that would be submitted about the effect of that would really need to be pursued in a separate proceeding, if it could even be pursued at all. So it might be something to look into in the event to file some type of motion, whether it's on a remand or after an appeal if we're not successful, to set aside the verdict based upon a juror misconduct, if indeed that rises to that standard. I have not researched that issue, but I share your concern.
Well, I just interject this information. I interject this information so that it might be a matter for record. Should this issue prove valuable in proceeding further or investigating this confession by Mr. Oberg on perhaps jury misconduct? Yeah. So
yes,
I'm going to get off and listen, let you go on. Enjoy the program tonight, gentlemen.
Thank you, Norm.
I really appreciate it.
Maria, you were there at the federal trial. Could you give us a little more information of the makeup of the jury?
You know, it might have been David Oberg, but what I noticed when looking at the jury, when I was talking, I was actually talking about jury nullification during my testimony, and I was really surprised at how long the federal prosecutors let me go on and talk about jury nullification before In fact, they never shut me down. They allowed me to talk about it as long as I felt like talking about it. But as I looked over at the jury while I was testifying, I only saw recognition about what I was talking about in one person's eyes. I was only connecting with one person on that entire jury. And so that's my impression. They weren't very engaged, very bright people. And that's what I know about them. I haven't been able to go over any of the jury selection audio files that we have yet.
Now, Maria, did you testify before Schaefer or after? I don't know.
I think I testified before him.
Okay.
Yeah.
RJ, you talked a little bit in our earlier phone conversation about what is involved in putting this appeal together, the kind of hours that you would have to invest to bring this about. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I believe that people need to realize just why we need to dig a little deeper and help out financially here. Give them some perspective of the amount of work that's involved.
Well, when I represented Schaefer in the state court, I didn't keep exact track of time because I was not paid to keep track of time, but my hours were over 500 and probably approaching closer to 1,000 hours of time to get that result. And I would expect if I were going to handle an appeal or whoever would handle an appeal would be putting in a minimum of 500 hours of time. And if it came to 1,000 hours, I wouldn't surprise me. And I tend to go overboard just trying to review things and think about them and pursue every angle. It wouldn't surprise me if I were to spend more than 1,000 hours of my time handling Schaefer's appeal. So it would be very much, when I represented Schaefer before, his case kind of took over my law practice for the 6 to 8 month period, and everything else was kind of getting extended and pushed back, and it was, in a way, very stressful, but I was working it and doing my best. So from the benefit of hindsight and just knowing what would happen, if I were going to represent Schaefer, I'd like to be in the position of being able to set aside 6 months of time or whatever to basically focus on doing my best to win this appeal, to go through it thoroughly. And one of the difficulties of the appeal is in this process, you bring this in front of three judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. These judges are inundated with appeals. They have lots of things to read and the like, and they only have so much mental energy to put on any given case. So one of the most difficult things in this case is going to be take this whole mammoth series of events and six-week trial and boil it down into something of perhaps 50 to no more than 100 pages. So it's something that someone who's just reading this can get a grasp on and say, oh, yeah, this is wrong, without getting overwhelmed with things and losing track of the big issues. So part of the problem would be is sifting through everything and trying to maybe there's 10 or 12 issues on appeal, but what are the best five issues maybe or so, and trying to boil this down to something where you're going to succeed with the audience you have, because you're going to grab their attention and you're going to hold their attention for the amount of attention they have and make them think, yeah, this is wrong, we need to reverse this. So it's a very intricate process that requires a lot of work, and actually it's very more difficult to write a good brief of 20, 30, 40, or 50 pages than it is to write something of 100 pages, because you have to take all that time and boil it down and really focus it. So it's going to be, for me or whoever would undertake this, really a mammoth effort. And if you look at Ms. Elliott, she's had the case, I believe, for about a year right now since Schaefer was sentenced. I believe it was in sometime January or February of 2000, 13. So just to give that for an example, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if it takes me 6 months to a year.
I believe my Skype connection may be trying to go in and out on me here, so if I fade out, don't be surprised. I'd like to
Terry, this is Maria. I think RJ might have just dropped off. Did he?
RJ, are you still there?
Yeah, he
I
might
believe
need
you might be right. You might be
I'm sure he will
call back in.
Okay, you go ahead then.
I know that BTR, Block Talk Radio, has been a little bit unstable for a few days, according to from what I've heard from rumors of other shows. The platform's been a little shaky. RJ's back on live now. RJ, did we lose you for a minute?
I think I went bop, 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 but it was right toward the end of what I was speaking, but I was basically, you know, talking about the difficulty in not just the amount of time that's going to be involved, but to basically take this mammoth amount of information and present it in a way that the judges who are inundated with information from a whole bunch of appellants are able to grasp this case and seize upon the problems and recognize the problems.
Yeah, it's easier to be to bloviate than it is to be concise, isn't it?
Yes.
And attorneys, of course, don't have too much trouble bloviating, right?
It's easy for us to just talk and talk. It's hard to...
I'm sorry, I just had to plug you.
No.
Red Beckman, Red, unmute yourself. I know you've got some thoughts on this, and maybe it's a good opportunity to ask some questions about your First Amendment thoughts and get the feedback from RJ as to whether or not that's something that can be brought out at this point. Red, are you with us? We're not hearing you, so you might be muted. I think I hear you rattling around. Well, Maria, did you have a question that you wanted to ask a while ago?
I did.
I thought you had some.
Yeah, I wanted to ask what the time frame is and what needs to be done at this point, because I know there's been a distinction made between the appeal and going after certain prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, right now, my understanding is in order to get the appeal, it's somewhat imperative that someone get in to replace Suzanne Elliott, the retained attorney, because if she kind of is able to cement the case in by filing a brief and getting the government to respond to it, it might be kind of hard to unring that bell. So basically right now, I think it's important to sooner the better to get if I can get in there to represent Schaefer on the appeal as a private attorney, not working for the government, to do it, and then get her out of there. The time frame as far as my getting a brief in would probably be 6 months or more. I'm just looking at the fact it's taken her a year, and I'm pretty busy as it is, and I would need to stop taking other cases in and kind of deal with what I have or push it off down the road a ways one way or the other. And realistically here, I mean, we're talking about trying to get some level of financing, whether some of it may go to me or if there's someone else, and this is one of the other things. If I'm handling the appeal, I want to be focusing on that to do the best job in the appeal. I don't want to be simultaneously trying to go back in the trial court and pursue government misconduct, because then I'm going to be spreading myself too thin, and it would be good if someone else can get on with that. So, to, you know, we were talking about some figures there to get me caught up. Well, that would be kind of an initial level, but really to get this to the point where we can have meaningful private representation, we need to get somewhere into the six-figure range. You know, if we're going to have this adequately financed, I'd like to get it well into the six-figure range, just because one of the things in law, as in many other things, it's better to have something and not need to use it than to need it and not have it. And when the government was able to, you know, basically out-resource the defense in this case. So, I mean, and that's just the way they have. They have all the resources. And to come up with, say, several hundred thousand dollars, maybe even up to $500,000, and have that as a war chest to fight this out is really a pretty small amount of money in the bigness of the political picture, and hopefully that wouldn't all need to get used and there'd be some left over. But this is a major battle with major ramifications, not just for Schaefer, but for all of us. And you know, the tragedy of Schaefer is he's a family man, first and foremost, and he had a 2-year-old kid, and he had a child who was just born a month before this happened, and those children are going to grow up without him, and he's not going to be able to experience their childhoods, their teen years, if we don't get this set aside.
Well, and, you know, that's a huge number to contemplate. I mean, even just the thought of six figures, but it's probably a good time to talk about the fundraising. And I want to make sure that people on the call know that the entire fundraising effort is going to be backed up by a national board of directors, and we're putting that together and hope to have an announcement that the national board of directors is being formed. But the entire campaign is branded as Free Schaefer Cox. So anywhere you go, you know, no matter what your search engine is, if you put in Free Schaefer Cox or go to freeschafercox.com, on an ongoing basis, people will be able to contribute to that. But because it's such a huge undertaking, for us as the fundraisers, we want to really stress that this is about due process, it's about the rule of law, it's about all of us. And it's about setting precedences. So what we're really saying is, you know, many hands make light work. Nobody has to really take the burden on, you know, more than, say, you know, whatever it is that they can afford to do. Lots and lots of people donating small amounts of money, and we plan to be in it for the long haul and to continue raising money. But so people know, there's crowdfunding campaigns and lots of different things that we'll be doing, but the main effort is under the heading Free Schaefer Cox. So go to freeschafercox.com, share freeschafercox.com, and, you know, we can do this. You know, lots and lots of people sharing it can make it happen, and then people that are motivated to as to what the importance of this is. And that's where you and the interviews come in. So
thank you, Maria. This is of paramount importance to all of us.
And we are just beginning. You know, for the last 3 weeks we've been fundraising, and it's a shame that we didn't have it going on for the last 2 years. I wish we would have, but RJ, you gave us renewed hope when you went and visited Schaefer and talked about stepping into the case. And what I'm wondering is, what would motivate somebody like Suzanne Elliott to want to stick to her guns and stick with a person that she's defending that she doesn't really want to defend or believe in?
I can't really answer that. I'm not sure I can offer some conjecture. And part of it may be just, you know, and this was brought up earlier, is just her perspective on things. She doesn't share the perspective of folks from Alaska, and it's somewhat, I call it, of a geographic disconnect, in the sense that, you know, the world she lives in is around Seattle, and what happened up here with Schaefer and everything else is almost, I think, alien to her, and she can't get a mental grasp upon it, and she can't come to see that the government can, in fact, do what it does and do what it did in Schaefer's case. And to me, that one of the things here, this isn't really along political lines in the sense that anyone of any political persuasion who's concerned with civil liberties should be shocked with what happened in Schaefer's case, because it happens to different groups in different points in history, as I said before, and this is really not just about necessarily a certain political persuasion being attacked, though it is part of it, certainly. It's like it could happen to anyone, regardless of what you believe, if the government doesn't like what you're talking about, and there are some serious First Amendment issues in this case as well, it could happen. And I know when I talked with Schaefer's attorney, Mr. Traverso, he was concerned that the jury was not properly instructed as to the First Amendment in this case, and that may be one of the issues on appeal as well.
That's what Red was talking to me about before, and I was hoping that he could get in here and ask a question on that.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yes, Red, we hear you now.
Yeah, okay. You want me to put my 2 cents worth in?
Absolutely. We always want your 2 cents worth, Red.
I'm not that familiar with all of the proper procedures and everything, but as I was listening in here, I thought, boy, in the freedom movement, which is becoming larger by the day in this country. And I think we need to really start, educating each other so that we don't have repeats of like the Montana Freeman catastrophe and now the Schaefer Cox and such. And we need to start educating judges and prosecutors and such. And I've been at this a long time, and I've seen a lot of people get hurt very seriously in tax court and criminal prosecutions and all that type of thing. And I sued a federal judge at one point in time, and the Solicitor General, when the case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court, the Solicitor General agreed with me that I was correct. And what I had done was I had filed 3 or 4 federal actions, and in each and every case I had demanded a jury trial. And the Justice Department would put in a motion for summary judgment. Excuse me. Anyway, the judge would dismiss the action for failure to state a claim upon which relief couldn't be granted, which is a lot of nonsense. And and the judge, I had demanded a jury trial. Well, as far as I was concerned, he was guilty. He was violating Title 18, Sections 241, 242. He was denying me my constitutionally secured right for a jury trial, Seventh Amendment. And I think that, and of course, we, in all the cases where I've been involved, we've been able to shut down the tax court by just, the tax court is not a court. There is no constitutional due process. The judge makes all the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and all we've been doing is just citing the judge, tax court judge, with the fact that he has a very serious conflict of interest, because he is a beneficiary of the tax laws in this country. He's got a conflict of interest, And as far as I know, every case that we've been involved in, we've been able to shut it off, and people don't have any more trouble because the judges are recognizing that, and the prosecutors are recognizing that they have been violating people because of their conflict of interest in these cases. Now, a federal judge, like in Schaefer Cox's case, and the prosecutors and all, these people are all very happy with their situation because they have a good pension plan, they have a good health plan, and everything else. And then we people in the freedom movement, we come along and say, wait a minute. You people work for a government that has put us into such debt in this country that our great-grandkids aren't even going to be able to pay it. And, of course, our great-grandkids aren't going to pay it because they're going to be taxed without representation and that type of thing. And so we in the freedom movement across the country, and this goes for the people in Alaska right now, the people that have been fighting and trying to see some correction made in our political system, they've got to start talking about prosecutors and such being on a federal payroll, and they're beneficiaries of the tax laws. They're beneficiaries of all this power, ill-gotten power that they're using. Now, the First Amendment, of course, this case with Schaefer Cox, it starts the Bill of Rights, so the whole thing, all 10 of them, were put there to protect you and I, for the people, and to make us, we were to be separate powers. We were to have a system of separation of powers. An AR-15 is a separate power, and it is to be a check against these politicians that lie and steal, and they lied to us about Pearl Harbor and Korea and Vietnam, Social Security, energy shortage, Kennedy assassinations, two of them, and they've lied about everything, and they lied about the 16th Amendment, and we now have a federal judge admitting that he knew that, but he says that they've changed the Constitution. Well, who changed the Constitution? The only people that can change the Constitution are we, the people, and because that's our law, and it's the law we wrote, and so we've got to somehow or other, we've got to reach the people in the freedom movement to where they start speaking out about judges and prosecutors and such misusing their power, because they don't want me. They don't want Schaefer Cox. They don't want an AR-15 to be a separate power as a check against them. They don't want that. That makes them very uncomfortable. And at this point in time, they should all be very uncomfortable because of what they have done, what this federal government has done to we the people of this country and done to our economy, to our jobs and everything else. They murdered 50 to 60 million in the abortion clinics, and then they brought in aliens to take care of the workforce that they had aborted. This has got to be brought out, and this is where the freedom movement has got to speak up, and they've got to bring out the fact that federal judges are political appointees. They are given a lifetime ticket to government welfare of the highest order, and we've got to start pointing the finger at them and saying, hey, you're a public servant. You are not a master. You can't change the Constitution. If you don't like what we're saying, you don't use government powers to try to shut us down. If you don't like what we're saying, you resign your job, and then you get out on the stump out here and speak out and say that we in the freedom movement are crazy, that we're delusional, and all of that. You don't dare do it while you're sitting on that bench. You don't dare do it as long as you're a government-paid, a tax-consuming public servant. You don't dare come out and say that Schaefer Cox is a danger. You don't dare. He's a danger to you and your racket. And we need to be talking about it in those kind of terms. And so I get a little riled up, and so I hope you don't mind. That's my 2 cents worth for tonight.
Thank you, Red. Well, RJ, that's a lot to respond to. I'm just going to see what your reaction to that is.
Well, I agree with it. Basically, it just made me think of a couple things that the facts in Schaefer's case that I don't know that people are necessarily aware with is when I was looking at the discovery in the case and trying to figure out how did this thing all start and the government starting to monitor Schaefer, it started with something called the Sovereign Citizen Task Force, and that was what started the monitoring of Schaefer. So they may say this is all about guns and the like, but I think really at the heart of what they were trying to do was to shut down and you know, basically make an example of Schaefer for it. So anyone who is going to speak out or pursue any sovereign citizen ideas, we should be very afraid. And one of the things that happened in the takedown of Schaefer on March 10th or 11th was that they went to a property there where Schaefer thought he was going to meet this truck driver, finally, the guy who was going to take him to freedom, and it turned out they were trying to put some weapons in Schaefer's hands there, and there were dozens, if not over 100 federal agents stationed around the property, and probably much to the government's chagrin, the person whose property it was saw, well, wondered what was going on, and he walked up to the vehicle that J.R. Olson and Schaefer and Coleman Barney and I don't know if anyone else was in, and said, "What are you guys doing here on my property?" And, you know, Schaefer or someone started telling him what was up, and then the guy said, "Well, why are there these 100 federal agents with bulletproof vests standing around here?" And at that point in time, J.R. Olson rolled out of the car and rolled underneath the car. So one has to wonder if, in fact, they weren't trying to put weapons in Schaefer's hand and maybe put an end to things at that point in time. So it's just some food for thought there. But, you know, there are some concerns here with, you know, conflicts of interest in these cases. And, you know, when you think of it, who's paying the salary of the federal judge? Certainly, well, it's the federal government.
Absolutely.
That's about all I have right now on that.
Maria, is there something else you wanted to try to cover tonight? We've got about a half hour left to go in the show.
Probably just really let people know that we're raising funds. We're going to get what we want to do is we want to get RJ back on the case. And the reason that we want to do that is because he lives here and he's Schaefer's friend. He's known Schaefer a long time. He's really Schaefer's only hope on this. And so I want to encourage people to go to the website again, freeschaefercox.com. And we've got it all over Facebook, trying to share it in social media. We're also building a good database for email messages. And if people want to get on the email message, they should get in touch with me. And just email me, and I'll put you on the list. And my email address is shapeitup2013@gmail. If that's difficult, you can just you can go onto Facebook and look at the Free Schaefer Cox Facebook page. I don't think we have email set up through the freeschaefercox.com website yet, but we will shortly. So just make yourself available. Keep in touch with us. I did get a note of encouragement the other day that we have a friend that's going to try to listen to some of the court's transcripts. We've got the first 13 days that the court here has given to us, and he's going to spend some time listening to those, maybe do some preliminary summaries on that, and then he also said that he would be donating on a monthly basis. So if people think about that and make a donation that maybe is $10 a month or $20 a month, and you wouldn't necessarily miss $10 or $20 a month, but it would happen without even thinking about it. That's the kind of fundraising that could really make a difference on this. So
I'd like to make a suggestion that we probably have some oath keepers listening tonight, or people who are members of the 10th Amendment Center or 912 group, or certainly there's some that are Tea Party groups. I'd like to suggest that you bring this up to your organization and see if you can get some support and put this word out and let this go viral, that this is how important this case is, that we show them that we're not going to stand by and allow good people, particularly those who are best and brightest, to be abused in this way and cheated out of their lives and their families, and that we're not going to stand by while they pick on one person. One of the major reasons why Schaefer got himself into hot water is because he started the Liberty Bell Group, the program where if one person is getting picked on, you call up a computer system and it puts a lot of other people on notice. And his talks and his gatherings were starting to grow. He was getting a lot of people showing up to hear him speak. And that's the kind of thing that really put the fear in these people, because they knew that their gig was up. If they can't keep people from going out and really educating other people, then there's going to be a large groundswell of people coming against this racketeering that's going on and our government and the tyranny that's going on, and that's what gets them scared. So we've got to get Schaefer out to show them that taking down one of us is not going to cut the mustard, because 10 more are going to rise in their place. And that's what this fundraising for Schaefer is all about. We've got to take a stand. We've got to come together. We've got to show them that it's not just one person they're fighting, but millions that they are fighting. Because there are millions of us out here that are awake, and we need to prove it by putting our money where our mouth is.
Yeah, and that is so important, because we just started this effort 2 weeks ago, and we've already had, I got notice tonight right before we got on the call that there's been an article about this in USA Today, and Schaefer's, some of my emails have been picked up this past week by the Daily Paul. Schaefer's 30th birthday was picked up by the Daily Paul, so worth some notoriety on it, but this is really an interesting dynamic here, what's happening locally and what's happened in Alaska. And our local paper has already put out an article talking about how unsuccessful our fundraising was after a week. And if you ask me, I think it's probably a total of 3 weeks, and the Indiegogo campaign in 2 weeks hit about $2,000. And then we're really up to, from various sources that are coming in to directly to RJ and things like that, we're really up to about $5,000. So in 3 weeks, we've raised $5,000 for this. But that doesn't stop the paper from bad-mouthing and talking and just putting their negative spin on this effort that we're making. So it's a
We got people on Twitter out there. Go on your Facebook or your Twitter. If they want to get some data farming, let's give them some. Let's put it on there. I just contributed to the Free Schaefer Cox campaign. let's counteract the lies of the government controlled press and make our own news. That's the way we got to approach it.
That's exactly right, and that's what we're doing, and that's why last night we have a great gal that met Schaefer in Montana when he was speaking, and she's been on his Free Schaefer Cox page for quite a while. I'm not even sure how long, at least a year, I would think. And she said, let me help. I'm a professional marketing person. Let me help. She's put together an Indiegogo campaign. She put together the entire website. And she's really done a tremendous amount to change the dialogue. And even here in Fairbanks, and you got to understand the local area here, the local town here, is probably the worst when it comes to, if I bring up Schaefer Cox, if I bring up, you know, anything about him, it's a lot of negativity that comes back to me. And so even here, there's been a big dialogue on some of the social groups, batting this around and going back and forth, and we're saying, no, he's not delusional. There is a reason to hope. We've got a lot that we can do. If everybody just contributes a small amount, and then their side comes back with negativity, and then we go back. But even in fair-fencing a sea change in what it is when you bring up Schaefer Cox, people are starting to see, okay, the guy got railroaded. We know he had a little bit of an ego. We know he made some mistakes when he spoke up in court here. You know, we know that sometimes there were things that we wouldn't have done that might not have been the best thing to do, but we also know that 26 years for not being perfect is ridiculous, and we want to help him. So there is a sea change happening in Fairbanks. I sense it happening in Alaska. And the way to turn this thing around and make it, make it the freedom movement thing to do, make it the liberty-minded thing to do, to stand up for people like Schaefer who've been railroaded and just been taken out for what amounts to thought crimes and, being who he is. And we talked about that, I guess, on the last program. But I sense a change in the winds that are blowing through this town, and I'm really encouraged by it, and I hope everybody will be encouraged by that.
Well, let me just say that Schaefer's passion, it's not all ego. It's some of it's doing what our Creator told us to do, and that is to take dominion and subdue. I mean, people could have said the same thing about Red Beckman. I've never met a more humble man in my life than Red. But when it comes down to speaking out about his sovereign rights that were granted to him by the Creator, he's going to speak out boldly about it and not take it from anybody that wants to squelch those rights. And that's what Schaefer was really trying to do. And I commend him for that. And we've got Richard Neff live mic. Richard, welcome to Walls in Our Minds, and glad you finally made it.
Well, thank you, Jerry. Yeah, I've been listening in here a little bit. Had a little trouble listening in tonight, but I finally got connected, and I appreciate all the comments and things that are being said. And Red was great. And I was going over, pulled up a little sheet here where I had, I was at the sentencing. I was in and out of the trial, and I was at the final arguments and, of course, sentencing, and I'm a friend of Schaefer's. Everybody knows that. And I remember some stuff that will kind of resonate through this subject tonight that You know, in the final the judge's opinions, he rejected almost all that was submitted by the defense attorney Peter Camille when he talked about the 70 plus support letters that IACTA collected those letters. I was Peter Camille, the attorney, asked me to do that, do the hard work of correcting it and forward them to me, and you'll save me a lot of work. So I did that. So I got the privilege of reading some of them. And it was a great, it was a really great bunch of testimonies that were nice. And basically, I want to say I made some notes. I'm looking at them now. They were brief. They were quick notes that I have to kind of reference here. But anyhow, in this discussion, the judge discounted the theme of the letter suggesting that Schaefer's family needed him for financial support, saying reduced sentencing time was not appropriate unless the sentencing created an abnormal hardship to his family. In short, the judge insulted those of us that wrote all the letters. He really did. And I was there. I'm kind of going by what I thought he said at that sentencing. I guess somebody could read the transcripts and confirm this, but that was my opinion at that date. And it seemed like a violation of our Constitution. You know, I looked up our Constitution, tried to read it and interpret it. On that line, it was like, you know, unconstitutionally cruel and excessive for crimes, a breach of the Constitution writings, you know. I think Schaefer got that. He was abused in that sense. And this is some of the stuff I'm quoting from him, the judge. Another area was that I had thoughts on was the fact that, I don't know what RJ would say about this, but what went through my mind at the sentencing was like, you know, this guy was not, he was not tried in his area, in his district. I guess maybe there's some legality that I don't know about, but I'll tell you what, they managed to get him to go to Anchorage and draw a jury out of Anchorage, and I was born and raised in Fairbanks, and I can tell you, the Anchorage jury is not the same as a Fairbanks jury. So I thought that's what our Constitution was talking about. So that's kind of a note that I had made during that time. I'm kind of going down through notes on my sentencing thing here. Another thing was
it certainly made it more difficult and expensive and cumbersome for people to attend the trial. I mean, I'm sure you guys had to pay for hotel rooms and travel and take the time away from your work and everything else to do what you did.
Absolutely. It was, I watched some of that during the trial. It was horrific what the government would fly somebody in from the state someplace and just to say, are you the guy that sat there and listened to that conversation between A.R. Olson and Schaefer? Yep, I'm him. Okay, and they'd relieve it. You know, they flew him up there, put him in a hotel room just to say that, and Schaefer'd have to pay for all that. But and I said the other night on your show when I was on here that I was one that, of course, called Nelson Traverso a few times myself personally and said, and I know Nelson, and I said, you know, if there's anything I can do for that boy, I want to do it, so call me. I want to be there. Never got a call. And I would definitely have testified to his credibility, I would have, in a heartbeat, in any way I could have. So it seems funny that the defense didn't do that for him. Another note I had
RJ,
in here.
RJ's here, so if you got a question for RJ, he's on with us. So.
Well, RJ will hear this, what I said about that being tried out of his district. I mean, I don't know if they've got that covered or not. They pulled it off anyhow. I wanted to run down through my list here a little bit. Another thing was early on in the case when the feds took it over and, you know, after RJ won the state case and got everything dropped, all these charges, which seemed to me to be very similar charges, if not the same. I don't know. Seemed like they tried him twice, but I'm not sure RJ could comment. But they said in the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer, they said, they don't have to quite operate under the same rules as the Alaska state of Alaska does. That was in the Fairbanks Daily Newsletter. That's my memory. That seemed like a constitution. Well, maybe they don't have to abide by the Constitution since they're feds. I don't know. So that was my interpretation.
RJ, you have a response?
In that regard, the Alaska Constitution is a little more protective of rights than the federal Constitution is, and I was able to win the state case on one of those more protective issues without even having to get into the federal issues, but I started pursuing those federal issues in the motions that were filed in federal court, and even though the federal Constitution isn't as protective, it seemed like the government stepped way beyond the safeguards that are allowed under the Fourth and Fifth Amendment regarding searches and seizures and due process of law. So those were issues that were definitely raised. The judge just, it was kind of almost shocking to me that when I was arguing these issues and we put on our evidence about them in the motion practice, the government didn't really make any attempt to refute the facts. They just kept arguing to the judge what a dangerous man Schaefer Cox was. And the judge, when he ruled against our motions, didn't really explain why he was ruling against our motions. He just seemed to say what they did was okay, and he left it at that basic conclusion without even explaining logically how he could reach such a conclusion. So that was some of the things that I perceived in that regard. As far as I talked a little bit earlier, the government did have the ability to file the case in Anchorage, and of course it would have been better if they filed in Fairbanks, but that's why they didn't. I didn't mention this earlier, have the chance a little before the program. Schaefer just happened to give me a call today, and I talked to him and brought him up to speed about what was going to happen this evening, and he was fearless in doing the right thing and saying what needs to be said, and his belief in that has not wavered. He's just, in order to get out and continue on in the great and amazing things he's going to do, and to get back together with his family and live the life a person should be entitled to live, he's really, really needs your help right now, and it's really important that people band together in this, because I don't think one can underestimate the benefit of if a banner headline appears in Fairbanks papers, and this would probably be ultimately a national story that says Schaefer Cox convictions overturned, case dismissed, the ramifications and the ripple effect of that would be profound, and it would be so powerful that this is really something that everyone should get behind in trying to make that happen, looking forward to that day when we see that.
Amen.
I wanted to mention, Thanks, RJ. I wanted to mention, too, a friend of ours that I haven't met yet from Vermont took a whole bunch of copies of something that Schaefer's got on the website, or that we put on the website that Schaefer had written, to a Tea Party group the other night. He said he printed out 50 copies, and he was able to give out 40 copies and kind of spread the word about freeschafercox.com and what was going on based on just something he had found posted up on the website. So I wanted to point people's attention. If you want to learn more about the case, there might be things we didn't bring up tonight and what have you. If you go to Free Schaefer Cox, we're always adding more information. Things that Schaefer writes to us from the CMU, and there's a long narrative on there that Schaefer wrote telling his story in his own words that you can look at. There's also a sizzle reel. It's called the sizzle reel. It's a 5-minute video that was produced by a guy out of Salt Lake City that was on a Glenn Beck program called Pursuit of Truth. And Pursuit of Truth was Glenn Beck's way of searching for the next great documentarian is how they couch this reality show. So there were about 1,000 people who tried out to become the next great documentarian, and it just so happens that one of them produced a documentary, or was competing to produce a documentary about this 2-for-1 trial. So there's the clip for that is on the I'm getting all kinds of messages, so that's a good sign. Anyway, the clip for that documentary, it's basically an advertisement that's a YouTube video that competes to be the next great documentarian. It's up on the website, and I've been in touch with this guy, and what he told me was that regardless of what happens, he thinks that this will be produced, this story is going to get out and back outlet. So that's another real encouragement to me, to know that even the mainstream media is covering this.
Well, we've got about 15 minutes left. I want to get Doug Millar in here. Doug is the host of the Crusade Radio Where Angels Fear to Tread show, and he's also the one, Maria, that made the suggestion about putting together these boards of national boards for this fundraising project. And I believe Doug's got some comments to make regarding the fundraising, but I want to let you, Maria and RJ, know that I'm going to give each of you about 3 or 4 minutes to make your final comments here before the show ends. So just be thinking about that. Doug, you have a live mic.
All right. Thank you, Terry. Maria, before I cover some things I want to make quickly, please give your email slowly so people can write it down.
Oh, okay. Shape it up. SHAPEITUP 2013@gmail.com. And I was trying to think of a really good way to get that to people in case they couldn't understand what I was saying, but shape it up as in fitness, shape it up at 2013@gmail.com.
All right, thank you. All right, now, as I mentioned before, you need a Fairbanks advisory board, a state advisory board, and a national. But you're not going to get those people, for the most part, to come on board after they read about how the things that the feds convicted him of until you get his statements about, for example, this sovereign citizen task force, what that was all about and what his involvement was, especially his organization of the Liberty Bell Group, how he went to different states, and how he was a threat to the feds. And so he needs to spell that out in black and white, and then he needs to take each of the major charges against him that he was convicted of and refute them one by one. Otherwise, we're never going to be able to find the national leadership that we need on this issue, because I agree with the statement that this is one of the most important crimes and convictions affecting all of us in the Second Amendment in the history of our lives. And so I just want to throw that in there because of the fact that years gone by, and now finally getting some fundraising. As you said, this fundraising should have been started before he was convicted, and I can't imagine why not. And we need to get statements from his family, his parents, his siblings, of what's going on, and also from his wife, because I've heard some, things today about their relationship, and there's rumors going around that are just trying to destroy your chance of ever raising $10,000, let alone hundreds of thousands that are going to be needed to get this conviction overturned. So I just want to throw that in.
Thank you very much, Doug. We got just a couple of minutes for a comment. There's a Ms. Shamash. Who's that?
Richard.
Hello?
We've got a baby in the background there. Is this Pamela?
Oh, hi. I didn't know I was on. Sorry. Hey, I just wanted to comment. I'll make it quick. You know what? I just wanted to say that, you know, Schaefer Cox is, when it was in the Daily News Miner, the people were commenting, you know, horrible things about him. And I fought with them on that comment board like crazy. There's just a lot of misinformation, so I'm really glad that this is coming out and that, you know, that we have an opportunity to really speak the truth about what this is all about. And I also wanted to say that I think that the reason they targeted him is because he has a gift. I mean, I've just never seen anybody that could pull people together so well with one like mind and in agreement and educate large groups of people. I mean, he is truly gifted. And it was just, I can see, you know, they feel threatened by that because he tells the truth. And so I'm not a lawyer. I don't know a lot about the case other than I just know it was wrong and I'm backing him up and I can't wait to see him get out of there.
Thank you, Pamela. Just remember that some of those bloggers are paid to do that. Richard, you had a quick comment before I turn the floor back over to RJ and Maria for final comments.
Terry, can you hear me? This is Doug.
Yes. Yes, Doug.
I want to make this real quick, and that is the fact that I'm confident, based on my relationship with the leadership of the Gun Owners of America and they're involved in as life members of the National Rifle Association, if we can get these statements refuted and a good statement from both Schaefer Cox, but also from Robert John, that we can go then to the national leadership of Gun Owners of America and we're going to see some funding occur, but it's going to take, you know, they have trouble raising funds every time every issue because there's so many gun issues going on, but this is, you know, Sheriff Richard Mack would go also to the NRA and Gun Owners of America. He used to be a spokesman for them. There's a lot of help out there, but we got to build our groundwork first. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Richard, did you have something to say quickly?
Well, I just had a few things. I had a few more notes here on, you know, Schaefer's more serious charges were for conspiring to own some weapons and conspiring to murder some officials. That means getting in his mind. And I didn't like that part, but that's what got him a lot of time. And another thing was I wanted to say that judge said a few things that I took exception to, and this is it. This case is not about freedom of speech. This case is not about overreaching government trying to silence Schaefer Cox. There was no militia. This government did not entrap Schaefer Cox by using informants. I think that judge misspoke when he said those four things at sentencing. That's all I say tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard. Maria, you want to go first and let RJ have the last three?
Absolutely. I think that judge lied when he said those things. I think those are out-and-out lies. I just want to remind everybody, and I appreciate from Red the comments about putting the boards together, and that's in process. So I heard everything you said, and I agree with you, and I appreciate your counsel on that. And visit Free Schaefer Cox frequently and find out what we've got up there and do what you can to help out. And I appreciate you very much, Terry.
Thank you, Maria. RJ, close us out. You got about 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll go for a few minutes at least there. Kind of to follow a little bit on what Richard said is that judge was definitely wrong about what he said about this case. The case started, I brought up the Sovereign Citizen Task Force. That was a federal task force that was investigating the whole sovereign citizen movement. So this case is about the Second Amendment. It's about the First Amendment. It's about the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, and it may well be have Ninth and Tenth Amendment issues as well. But this case runs the gamut of problems that are wrong with our society right now in ways in which the government has gone overboard and gotten out of control. That's one part of it, and the worst part of it is the victim of all of this is one of the greatest individuals in our current world right now in our society, and that's Schaefer. He's a genuine, charismatic person with rock solid beliefs, who stands up for his beliefs and speaks out about those beliefs, and here he is sitting in jail, and he should be out in our society, helping us all move society forward to be the better society we all want it to be. And really, right now, he needs all our help in the ways we can all help him, and that's kind of what this is all about. I'll do whatever I can to communicate with folks to get more information out there, and I look forward to working with Maria and the rest of you toward presenting information, toward getting funds, toward getting the issue out, toward getting people to realize how absolutely important this case is for all of us. And it's important to Schaefer in the sense he's an innocent person. That's the thing we can't forget about this all. He is wrongly accused. He's wrongfully accused, and not only is a wrongfully accused person convicted, the government has gotten away with government overreaching that's going to continue until somebody comes up and we get courts and people to come up and say, this is wrong. This cannot go on. This cannot happen to another person again. But we need to establish precedent. We need to all get together and stand up for our best interests. And sometimes you need to have something to move forward with that. We all need examples. We need precedent. Schaefer's case is perhaps the best thing that's been presented to us right now to at least to use to the court system. And we don't want to use just the court system. Of course, we want to continue on all fronts. But we have this opportunity right now to establish good precedent that will help us all and to free a wrongfully accused man to get on with a wonderful life he has with his family, a life that's not going to benefit just him and his family. It will benefit us all.
Amen.
Amen to that.
Amen.
Any other final comments?
I did want to say that the name of the Liberty Defense Fund, it's the and the Board of Directors, the National Board of Directors for the Free Schaefer Cox Liberty Defense Fund. And it is for the defense of all of us for our liberty.
I agree. All right. Well, if no other comment, I'm going to close this out in prayer. Thank you all for coming. RJ, I especially appreciate you taking the time tonight. And we're here. We're supporting what's going on. So feel free to call on me, call on us. Look forward to having you back here with some positive report. Almighty Yahweh, our Creator, our Father in Heaven, we lift up Schaefer Cox to you. And we know that if you want him to be free, he will be free. And we also know that you can use him right where he is. But we pray that you give him, you put your arms around him and have him know that there are people here who care for him, that you care for him, and put him to good use. We know that you have a better purpose for him than spending the next 25, 26 years of his life in that facility. We know, Father, that those that are his enemies are your enemies, and they are our enemies. help us each one to bring forth the resources that are necessary here to support Attorney Robert John and all of those that are attempting to free Schaefer. We just pray for success in this effort. We pray that you multiply our efforts, and we pray that your spirit be with him and lift him up and just go before us in this battle. We thank you for your son, Yahshua HaMashiach, our Savior. Amen.
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 Thanks for joining us tonight, everyone, and we'll see you next week and for Walls in Our Minds.
Thank you for your show.
Thank you.
A jackass chase a dumb pack of dumb. What a show. Tapping on any shoulder that I can find. If anyone in there might change their mind, it's time to go to the real world outside with those pirate ships, drunken sailors, dirty lips. They rule the night. They rule the night. Don't be afraid of the wicked men. There's more of us than there are of them. Come join the fight. Coming, we build a house of six, all the politics.